Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the vote late on Tuesday in the Senate overturning the CFPB's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's rule that now means consumers who have been defrauded by banks and financial institutions will now be forced into arbitration, where the record shows consumers only win 9% of the time and are often countersued and end up owing the banks that defrauded them an average of $7,725. Amanda Werner, the arbitration campaign manager at Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, whose appearance dressed as Monopoly Man at a recent Senate hearing on fraud and negligence by Wells Fargo and Equifax went viral on the internet, joins us to discuss how Republican critics of Trump, Senators Flake, Corker, and McCain, all voted with Trump against the American consumer in a tie-breaking vote decided by Vice President Pence. Now that the parasitic payday lenders are lining up to challenge rules that prevent them from fleecing consumers more than they already do, we will assess what this means for the future of the CFPB, which has returned $12 billion to defrauded customers while being under unrelenting attack by Republicans from day one. Then we'll speak with Sam Quinones, a former LA Times reporter who now writes for the New York Times and Los Angeles Magazine and is the author of Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. He joins us to discuss the low expectations for Trump's announcement Thursday to address the opioid crisis without anyone heading Health and Human Services and the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and how much the opioid epidemic is ravaging communities who voted for Trump in part because of the despair associated with their sense of a society falling apart from within. Then finally, with a poll just out from the Military Times that finds 53% of active duty military officers oppose their commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, we will speak with General Robert Gard, who was the U.S. Army's first director of human resources development and later served as president of the National Defense University. He joins us to discuss the alarming lack of staffing at the senior levels of the Pentagon, State Department, and National Security Council at a time when we have a reckless and ignorant president who the top generals in the White House are busy containing instead of addressing global crises. And joining us now is Amanda Werner, who is the arbitration campaign manager at Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, otherwise known as Monopoly Man. During the Senate hearings on Wells Fargo and Equifax, she was dressed as Monopoly Man, and that video of you has gone viral.
Indeed it has.
So you're a kind of a celebrity activist, but we don't have a lot to celebrate, do we?
No, unfortunately, last night Republicans voted to give Equifax and Wells Fargo a get-out-of-jail-free card for their crimes.
And let's elaborate on that, because it was a real close vote that Vice President Pence had to do the tie-breaking vote. There was an expectation that Senators Corker and Flake, both of whom had taken a stand against Donald Trump, along with Senator John McCain, would buck the GOP, but they didn't. And only Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and John Kennedy of Louisiana bucked the GOP. It was a tie vote, and the tie was broken by Vice President Trump. Now this is the first real hit against the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which the Republicans clearly hate.
Yeah, unfortunately, last night was a really big loss. And, you know, it wasn't just Flake and Corker that we were looking at. We were looking at, you know, the strong moderates that have emerged in the healthcare battle, Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski. We were definitely looking towards Senator McCain to do the right thing here. And unfortunately, I think all of these folks in the GOP, you know, they showed that they are not the true leaders, the true independents that they're trying to sell themselves as. You know, it's obvious if you're a true leader, you defend the little guy against powerful interests. You don't feed them to the wolves of Wall Street.
So how did the Trump people pull this off? I understand the acting controller of the currency, Keith Noreika, who's a former defense counsel for Wells Fargo, played a major role along with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, Chairman Noreika basically picked a fight with Director Cordray and tried to essentially make up numbers and tell the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that their data was wrong, that this study that they spent 3 years painstakingly conducting was somehow wrong. What's funny is the data that Noriega used was actually the same exact data that the CFPB had. He was willfully misinterpreting it to come to different conclusions based on the same numbers. And similarly, Steve Mnuchin, you know, put out this Treasury report on Monday. It was, you know, essentially trying to be this kind of October surprise almost, bombshell to the campaign. And again, it was just unfounded. They just pulled this report out of nowhere just as a way to get in the middle of this vote.
Well, let's look at the real issue here, which is Republicans in the Senate have just killed off the possibility of consumers getting redress against corporate malfeasance and consumer fraud. And they'll be forced into arbitration, as were consumers at Wells Fargo. Customers who got defrauded by them were forced into arbitration. And at Equifax, when I think the history of what was it now, it eventually came out to a couple of hundred million Americans, didn't it? The Equifax lost the data on. I can't remember.
There's 145 million Americans, which is basically three-quarters of the adult population. So almost everyone who has a credit report got their credit report leaked here. And, you know, the thing about this is, so as you mentioned, because they just took away our right to sue banks and lenders in court, now our only choice is to go into the secret arbitration system where the bank or lender actually chooses a firm to decide the case. And actually the average consumer in arbitration ends up owing the bank $7,725. But I think what's especially appalling here is when you're talking about Wells Fargo or Equifax, where there are literally millions of people who've been harmed, it's simply just not possible to have millions of arbitrations. Can you imagine if 145 million Americans had to individually file suits? There aren't enough arbitrators in the world.
Well, the consumer is definitely being screwed in arbitration, and that's why it's preferred. And the Economic Policy Institute did a study showing that consumers only win 9% of arbitration cases, and the banks almost always win. And as you mentioned, the banks then issue counterclaims where the consumer ends up paying $7,725 on an average. So this is really horrible, isn't it? And this is what I don't understand. I mean, I guess you have to credit the Democrats. Every one of them stood firm in support of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the Republicans were, of course, shameful. And even the ones that we thought were making a stand on behalf of the American people against the donor class that run the GOP and, to some extent, the Democratic Party, and Steve Bannon threatening to primary them, etc., we thought that the people that didn't have anything to lose, Jeff Flake and Corker, would do the right thing, but they didn't. So I don't know the answer for why that happened, but why is it that, and or how is it that these guys could get away with something like this? It's such a in-your-face insult to the average American.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I'm still really surprised that this even went down this way. You know, when it comes down to it, I think Republicans thought they were going to get this through when no one was looking. I think that's one reason that the vote last night went to, you know, past 10 o'clock. It was similar to healthcare. They were trying to do this in the dead of night so people didn't see it. I did think when the Monopoly Man took off and we had millions of people, you know, suddenly activated around this issue and really interested around Equifax and Wells Fargo, I thought they weren't going to actually dare to bring this vote again. But it turns out that, you know, they care more about their corporate donors than they do about what the constituents think of them, unfortunately.
And again, I'm speaking with Amanda Werner, who's the arbitration campaign manager at Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen. And at a recent hearing before the United States Senate, she gained notoriety for dressing as Monopoly Man, where the hearings were on Wells Fargo and Equifax. And the point here is, of course, that the campaign contributions from both Wells Fargo and Equifax, I believe, are to the tune of, what, $100 million in campaign contributions? Or are they from the financial industry themselves?
Yeah, over $100 million was given from the financial industry to the co-sponsors of this get-out-of-jail-free card, which is, you know, I think it just shows they bought and paid for this this repeal of the CFPB arbitration rule. And frankly, it was a great deal for them. They're going to save billions of dollars that they can take directly from consumers. You know, it's funny, one of the things that I think GOP used as a cover for this vote was somehow this idea that this is going to raise consumer costs, even though the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau looked at that and found that there was no merit to that claim. But what people aren't considering is how much it's going to cost consumers now that Wells Fargo and Equifax know they can do these things and get away with it. What's to stop Wells Fargo from taking, you know, $100 from each of their consumers if they know that none of us can actually hold them accountable when they do that?
Well, they almost did that, didn't they? Opening those phony accounts and then having secret insurance bills, etc., that consumers didn't ask for. And all of this was done in small print and with stealth. I mean, the numbers are pretty horrendous, aren't they, from the original Wells Fargo defrauding their customers?
Exactly, and that's because they were able to use forced arbitration. You know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was repealed last night would have stopped that, but essentially Republicans are freezing us in this moment where we're seeing, I think, essentially more bank fraud than we've seen since 2008. I think they're going to push us directly into another financial crisis when we barely started to emerge from the last one. I think it's about time that we start realizing that the Republicans are not the fiscally responsible party. We need to start moving away from that.
So, where does the Wells Fargo case stand then? I mean, is it everybody that got defrauded now forced into arbitration?
So luckily, because there was so much public pressure around the fake account lawsuit in particular, Wells Fargo has reached a preliminary settlement with folks just because they wanted out of the headlines, quite frankly. But there are multiple other class action lawsuits around other issues. For example, this auto insurance fraud, Wells Fargo was found putting unwanted auto insurance on hundreds of thousands of customers. So we have more scandals kind of coming from them every day. We also have overdraft fees that they illegally charge folks. And in all of those cases, they are continuing to try to force people into arbitration. So Wells Fargo gave up in this one circumstance because people were so outraged and there were so many bad stories written about them. But I think especially now that this rule has been nullified and they know that consumers have no way to fight back, I think it's only going to make them more bold.
So how is Trump celebrating this victory in Mnuchin? What are these Republicans saying to excuse their craven behavior?
You know, it's really sad. Mike Pence actually tweeted late last night, right after he made the vote, that he was proud to stand with everyday consumers. So, you know, I think they're going to celebrate this the same way they've been celebrating all of their other quote-unquote victories this entire year. They're going to lie about it and pretend that they're doing something good right as they're robbing us blind. And I'm glad that it seems like a lot of folks are seeing through that, and hopefully we'll see some justice for it someday. I think we got to keep the resistance going. We got to keep fighting back at every turn, even when we have really horrendous losses like we did last night. I'll be honest, I spent 2 years of my life working on that rule. It's a huge loss, but I'm glad to know that we are always going to keep fighting and keep pushing back against this.
Well, do you think that the Democrats, since they voted, all of them voted against or against this repeal and in favor of keeping the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's rules in place, are they going to use this as a campaign issue in 2008?
I certainly hope so. You know, the Democrats have been really strong on this issue in particular. Before the election, actually, it was part of the DNC platform was taking on forced arbitration, not only in the financial context, but also in employment and civil rights and tons of other areas where it's really destructive. And actually, just recently, a few weeks ago, the Democratic leadership has made it part of the Democrats' Better Deal plan. So I really hope that this is something they continue to pursue. And frankly, you know, if things go their way in 2018 and they're in a position to push this kind of legislation, I hope they'll do something broader. And so instead of having one rule that allows us to sue banks and lenders, I hope we'll have big legislation that allows us to sue any corporation and restores our Seventh Amendment right to a day in court.
So in the broader sense then, where does this put the CFPB? I know from day one the Republicans have been trying to kill it. They tried to change its very charter so that it would be a commission that could be stacked and neutered. They didn't ever like the fact that Cordray was appointed. They tried to stop that. And I believe Cordray is going to, his term is up as director of the CFPB, and now he's off. I think he's going to run for governor of Ohio, if I'm not mistaken. So where does it stand then in terms of the future of this? You know, obviously one of the reasons why the Republicans hate it so much is it's the brainchild of this Senator Elizabeth Warren. But it is the most effective and endearing part of the Dodd-Frank Act, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, you know, the CFPB has done such a great job since it opened up its doors just, you know, I think 6 years ago now. It's returned over 12 billion dollars to American consumers. It's been by far the most effective government agency I think we've really ever seen. And Director Cordray's leadership has been a huge part of that. So unfortunately, this is a big blow to the Bureau. I think it basically shows that with a Republican administration and a Republican Congress, they're not going to be able to do these kind of big sweeping rules. I hope they'll continue to use their enforcement power. They led the enforcement action against Wells Fargo when these fake accounts were first found. So I hope they'll continue to do that, to hold individual banks and lenders accountable when they break the law, since we can't actually do it for ourselves as consumers. But as you mentioned, Director Cordray's term is up in July, and he might, in fact, leave before then. We're not sure. So I'm a little worried about what's going to happen when Trump is able to appoint the head of the CFPB. It might end up being, the agency that starts to harm consumers.
Well, that's the track record so far. I mean, that it's extraordinary, the people that he puts in charge of government departments who are so hostile to the very mission of what they're supposed to do. I could go through the list, but I don't want to depress you, and I don't want to depress our listeners.
His only qualification seems to be who hates the agency the most.
Right. But so you mentioned earlier, though, you thought that these actions by the attorney from Wells Fargo, defense attorney for them, who's now with control of the currency, along with Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, who himself got rich by defrauding people and kicking them out of their homes and foreclosing on thousands and thousands of Americans. So these people, to my mind, are absolutely despicable from day one. But why do you think that this action against the CFPB could lead to another financial meltdown on Wall Street like we had in 2008?
Because forced arbitration not only means that individual consumers can't get their money back, it also means that we can't know when there's widespread fraud happening. So the way this played out with Wells Fargo is consumers have been trying to sue them since 2013 over these fake accounts. But because they were forced into secret arbitration where they couldn't share their story with law enforcement, couldn't talk about it to the media, we didn't find out about the fake accounts until 2016. And Wells Fargo in that time just kept profiting from it. So one real danger of forced arbitration is this secrecy that stops us from knowing, that hundreds of consumers are charging Wells Fargo with the same kind of fraud. And so we don't find out about it until our financial system has been significantly weakened. I think we saw that play out in the mortgage market in 2008, and I'm just very afraid now that banks can keep this kind of fraud under wraps. We don't know what's going to happen until it's probably too late to save the economy from crashing again.
Well, my understanding is that, just in closing here, that the fact that the Congress or the Senate just killed this rule will open the door for a similar attempt to kill the rule curbing payday lenders. And they're the worst of the bottom feeders, and they're worse than the mafia in terms of the vigorish that they force their borrowers to pay. Do you think that this will open the door for an attack on the rule curbing payday lenders abuse?
I mean, it's hard. It's definitely, it doesn't set a great precedent for defending public protections. We've seen the Republicans repeal Obama-era consumer protections dating, I think this is the 15th time they've done it this year. But this is the first time they've done a CFPB rule. And I think one reason for that is because the CFPB is very popular with Americans. They've been a little bit afraid to touch it. So I am worried about what this this defeat of the arbitration rule means for payday. I think it is going to be a hard fight. Fortunately, just with the timing of that rule, that fight is going to extend into next year, so we have some time to really build up support for it and make sure folks are knowing. And frankly, with the amount of people today that I think hadn't heard of this rule and now are so appalled to see Republicans repeal it, I hope that those folks next time around will be watching payday and will be able to participate before a vote is taken and put enough pressure that we can keep that one alive. But it's going to be hard.
Well, Amanda Werner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Werner, who's the Arbitration Campaign Manager at Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen. We're going to take a B-Station break. We're back speaking with the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic.
Tell you right now, you best believe that waste my life because I'm meaner to my vein. Leads to a center in my head, and then I'm better off than dead.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sam Quinones, who's a former LA Times reporter whose career as a journalist has spanned almost 30 years. He lived for 10 years as a freelance writer in Mexico and is the author of Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. Currently a freelance journalist writing for National Geographic, Pacific Standard Magazine, and the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Magazine. His most recent book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Quinones.
Good to be here. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Sam. And what do you expect will happen on Thursday, where President Trump is due to announce what he's going to do about the opioid crisis in this country that we've known about for some time? Right. My sense is, without being too editorial, is that we have government by stunt, that this is a man that's not really interested in solving problems, but doing publicity stunts in order to appear that he's actually governing. And we don't have anybody at HHS. We don't have a drug czar. We don't have anybody in the government, in the State Department or the National Security Council dealing with West Africa, where we have problems in Niger. We don't have anybody in the State Department or the National Security Council dealing with Kurdistan, which we are in the middle of losing to the Iranians. All around the world, it just seems that this is a government in crisis, but yet, they gave him a standing ovation yesterday in the U.S. Senate. So go figure.
Right. Yeah, I can tell you that I don't have a clue what to expect because of a good deal of what you mentioned. It's never quite clear on this issue. It's not really quite clear whether he understands the issue. I honestly don't know if he does. Terribly, he keeps talking about how this is a problem all over the world, and in fact, it is not a problem all over the world. It is only a problem in this United States. By that, I mean overprescribing of pain pills leading to heroin addiction and the igniting of an underworld interest in exporting opiates to our shores, Mexican heroin, fentanyl from all over, perhaps. So it's not clear to me he fully understands this. He's only said a couple of things. Is the national emergency, and we're going to spend a lot of money, and we're going to do a lot. And of course that means nothing. So I don't know. What I hope is that he will understand the enormous depth and breadth of this problem that goes, again, nationwide, killing more people last year, I think we're going to find, than Americans who died, all the Americans who died in the Vietnam War. I think this year will be worse, in fact. And so I would hope he would understand that. I would hope he would understand that the federal government's best role, most likely, is as a facilitator of local initiatives. The local governments actually are seen to be doing some good things. They are just stymied by maybe lack of power, but also lack of funding. I think he would do well to fund a whole lot more research by the federal agencies that do this, National Institute of Health, Drug Abuse, and all these kinds of places, a whole lot more CDC work on that could possibly be done as well. I think his commission, run by Chris Christie, had a lot of, in the draft that I read, had a lot of very good ideas. These were not original to the commission. A lot of people have been making comments that these, talking about these ideas for some time, in fact. But it's good to have a government imprimatur kind of on these ideas. I think they're good. The big question is, two big questions. One is, what will he propose we do that the federal government will do? But then also, and probably even more important, will there be any follow-through? Will there be any attention span given to this? Or will this be something that by Christmas, everyone will be going, what? I can't even remember what he said about this. You know, this is the great question. I could not possibly answer that question for you today as we sit here talking today. it's just too difficult, and he doesn't have a track record yet on this topic. He did mention it in campaign a few times, not to any great degree. It was one of the reasons why he said another wall would be necessary to stop heroin. That did not leave me with a whole lot of confidence that he understood the problem, because the truth is, heroin is the easiest of the major illegal drugs to smuggle, and we already have many walls along the border. It's a misconception that there's somehow a new a wall is now going to be a new thing on the border. We have many walls. Most of the top of the major crossing areas have walls, one form or another, and heroin is coming through those areas. The walls have not stopped heroin from coming through. So yet another wall, maybe 2,000 miles long, or whatever exactly is being proposed. The truth is, I'm not really quite clear always. Doesn't seem to me like an understanding either of this problem. Remember, heroin exists not because it has any medical benefit. Heroin exists because it's a perfect underworld drug. It is the perfect drug for the underworld. It's cheap to make, easy to cut, easy to conceal, and it creates customers that have to buy from you four or five times a day. There's no real medical benefit to it. The reason it exists today, the reason we have it around 100 years after it was invented or more, is because it was a magnificent drug for the underworld. A significant amount is smuggled in what they call in Mexico a la hormiga, kind of ant-like little bits and pieces, 3 kilos here, 2 kilos there, not in 50-kilo loads. I mean, some that comes in that as well sometimes, but you're talking about a kind of a trafficking that the drug itself lends itself to, piecemeal trafficking. A lot of people can make a significant amount of money by trapping a kilo or two or three. And I did a story for the New York Times three months ago, based on a conversation with a guy who was a farmer, a rancher, wanted to buy a cow, needed to buy some barbed wire, trafficked a kilo of heroin at a time. He'd been doing this 40, 50 times to help support his ranching. Finally got caught, got some prison time, was deported, can't go back. But nevertheless, the idea was, this is the more common heroin trafficker. Not that the big guys don't exist, they do, but it's just as common to find these many, many of these small-time traffickers. And that's why a wall would be, or yet another wall, as I like to say, would not work, doesn't seem to me.
Right, but Sam Quiñones, the big guys that created the opioid epidemic in this country that led to the reformulation of OxyContin, and which in turn led to a greater addiction towards heroin, are quite identifiable. They are the Sackler sure. family. They own Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma has an address. It's not like it's a jungle lab.
Right.
I mean, this is the amazing thing, that we have a Drug Enforcement Administration that goes after kingpins, and the source, well, the source of this epidemic is absolutely known. Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family, this multi-billionaire family of philanthropists.
The problem is that they have been criminally prosecuted already, is a thing. And this was in Southern Virginia. The company went through several years of subpoenaing of records, and essentially federal agents lived in the Purdue Pharma fifth floor for a number of years there as they investigated this case, and it went on and on. Eventually, they were prosecuted for a criminal misbranding, false branding, in terms of advertising, and fined $634 million, which is a lot of money, but it was nowhere near really the largest fine ever levied on a pharmaceutical company. It also happens to be not really very much money when you consider that the company has revenue from OxyContin alone is on the order of $35 to $40 billion since the drug came out in 1996.
And they spent $6 billion promoting it, and that's why it became pervasive.
Right, that and a bunch of other factors having to do with American culture seems to me as well were very important in all this. But yeah, they were known. They paid the largest bonuses to their sales reps by quite a bit. You know, by a factor of 4 to 6, it seemed to me, above any other company that's ever paid a bonus. And they were the most, they were known, those sales reps were Purdue back, particularly in the late 90s, early 2000s, were known as the most tenacious, the most unrelenting sales reps in the business, and earning $100,000 a quarter. Most people in the business, if they earn $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in bonuses a year, that was a fantastic year for them. But Purdue Pharma, it was $100,000 a quarter for a lot of the folks, particularly in Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, that very Virginia area. But they have been prosecuted criminally. I'm not sure. I'm not lawyer enough to know if that case makes it impossible to criminally prosecute them. Again, they are going to be civilly sued, and by a number, you know, attorneys general across the United States are lining up to do that. Now, that is a problem that's completely understandable on one level, because this is an entire scourge that has the profits for which have all gone to the private sector, mostly pharmaceutical companies. The costs of this are entirely borne, almost entirely borne, if you leave out the families, of course, of people get addicted, it's entirely borne by the public sector, jails, courts, coroner's offices, public health departments, CDC, DEA, cops, prosecutors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on, the list of public entities that have to bear some of this cost. So they're, of course, looking for ways to recoup those costs. They're trying. I think they would not be accountable to their constituents if they did not do this. The problem is, and again, I'm not an attorney, and I defer to any attorney with extensive background in civil law, but the problem seemed to me, after talking to a few folks, that these cases may drag on for years, and so it's not clear that it would be an immediate benefit to the counties that are looking to get out from under a lot of these very, very onerous costs. A lot of these counties are very poor, don't have a lot of budget, they're very small, but then also it may be difficult to make the case, because these pills, unlike tobacco, which this is often compared, these pills do have a medical benefit. Tobacco has none. There are many, many ways that these pills are a boon to the human beings and medicine in general. That's not the case of tobacco. Plus, there was a very long time, and all that's changing now, there was a number of years where aggressive use of these pills was accepted medical practice, accepted by many AMA, a variety of other groups who believe that pain should now be considered the fifth vital sign, that doctors need to very aggressively. So they may very effectively use the argument, these companies, that we were doing what was accepted, what everybody said was the right thing to do. And my understanding is that the courts have been reluctant to find fault with the company that's doing that, or doctors that are doing that. We'll see. It's going to be interesting.
Sam, my daughter runs a hospital back east, a lot of inner-city crime, gunshot wounds, etc. Very busy in the emergency room. She just told me that hospitals across the country are going to be running out of drugs, the very drugs we're talking about, the legitimate ones that are needed. And that's because most of them are made in Puerto Rico, which has suffered a massive hurricane. And so far, while Donald Trump takes credit for 10 out of 10 for what he's done in Puerto Rico, as far as we know, the only people who have benefited so far have been a small company out of Whitefish, Montana, who have links to the Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke. They've got a massive sole source contract to rebuild the electric grid, even though the company only has 2 employees. So there you have it. I mean, have you heard about this crisis?
No.
In terms of...
My feeling is actually that I was aware of some production in Puerto Rico, but my feeling was a lot of the production, is in Sri Lanka, India, places like that, across the halfway around the world. And maybe also in the United States to some degree. I could be wrong, but that would be I'd be interested. I will go look into that, as a matter of fact. Sure. Sounds like an interesting idea. I have not heard it.
Well, as I say, you know, she's in a position to know. And apparently this is a major crisis. And again, I started out by what some people may seem as dumping on Trump. But frankly, all of the real issues facing this country are not being addressed, with both in terms of foreign policy and domestic policy. And this is just another one of them, Puerto Rico. It should be clear to everybody. But just in the last couple of minutes, why then, when you mentioned the states that are most affected by the OxyContin epidemic that has led to heroin abuse, you've mentioned them. They're all red states who voted for Trump. So what's going on? How come the people who voted for this guy can't see how negligent he's been in dealing with a problem that's devastating their lives? And up to 200,000 people are going to die from this.
I think they voted for him before he had any policy or had to enact some policy. So I think they're going to find out if their vote meant anything. But I also think that I believe that opiates were part of why he won. I would say a major force in why he won. Why he won crucial states without which he could never become president. By those states, I mean Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina. You know, those pivotal key swing states that towards the end of the night, you remember were so important and all this. I was through several of those states in the fall before the election, and you just didn't, in the rural areas, you just didn't see anything Hillary Clinton sign. It was all Trump Pence. And just amazing thing. But I think there's several reasons why they voted for him. One was, it seems to me that you would look at these counties and you would say, they ought to be really happy. Look at their unemployment rate. There are a lot of these counties. I did checking on a lot of these counties. Those counties had unemployment rates of 15-17% in 2010. And now it was down to 5 or 6%. So you would think, gee, these ought to be areas where people are doing good. The problem is that opiates kept keeping a lot of people out of the market, of the job market. Plus, they tend to color every part of your life. If you know people who are addicted, it doesn't matter if they're not in your family, if it's the pastor's son or the quarterback on your kid's football team, it tends to make you feel like the entire world is falling apart. There's a negativity and a fatalism and an inertia and a downer, depressive sense to life that comes along with widespread addiction. It doesn't have to be a lot for this, a lot of addiction in a county to create that. And what I think happened was, this was going on for a number of years, but it wasn't widespread knowledge in 2012 when a lot of these counties went for Romney with just bare slivers of a plurality, maybe 48% to 47 or something like that for Obama, what have you. By 2016, they're going for Trump 75%, 60, 70, 75%, 80% sometimes. And I think the reason is opiates. The opiates made people feel like there was nothing anyone was doing. Things had gotten to such an awful extent that people were now dying of this stuff, and they needed, and they didn't care that the unemployment rate had dropped. Nothing else was going right, and it hid, the unemployment rate really hid the fact that a lot of people weren't even looking for work. And so a lot of these counties, I think there was this malaise, this deep dread of the future, brought on by opiate addiction of various forms, could be pills, could be heroin, could be fentanyl, whatever it happened to be. It was still this drenching thing that made people feel nothing was going right. And the truth is that Donald Trump appealed to those folks for a variety of reasons. One of them was that he kind of promised something radically, radically different. Nothing like, now Hillary Clinton did not promise that, I don't think. She did not symbolize that. She symbolized, I think, a lot of more of the same, both her last name as well as her attitude towards a lot of problems. But Donald Trump, whatever you can say about him, said, no, I've got a whole different thing. Believe in me. My own feeling is there were times when he felt a lot like heroin, you know, that I will solve all your problems and nothing will be, no problem will exist after I, and just what heroin's message is to most addicts, take me and I'll be, and everything will be, sure, will be fine. But nevertheless,
well, he said that, he said, I alone can fix it. So there you have it.
I alone can fix it. And I am new and I am different. And I do think, I'll tell you this, it's my hunch, and again, it's only a hunch, and I'm not much of a political consultant or observer any more than any other American, but I do think that this could be a serious Achilles heel as an issue for him if he does not follow through, if he does not do something and follow through with it for months at a time. Because it's stunning to me how many people who voted for, I thought there was a big correlation, the number of people who voted for him and the number of people who had addicts, opiate addicts in their family, just seemed to me to be very high correlation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so how those folks may react if this doesn't happen, or if his ideas are kind of halfway funded, or if his ideas are done and then forgotten, you know, the classic kind of Trump style, I don't know.
Well, Sam Quinones, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Sam Quinones, who's a former LA Times reporter whose career as a journalist has spanned almost 30 years. He lived for 10 years as a freelance writer in Mexico and is the author of Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. Currently, he's a freelance journalist writing for the National Geographic, Pacific Standard Magazine, and the New York Times, and Los Angeles Magazine. And his most recent book is Dreamland, the True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a poll just out from the Military Times that finds 53% of active duty military officers oppose their commander-in-chief, Donald Trump.
Can I have some more? Oh, the damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done.
Built to those assembled, they're taken for a ride, taken any stride.
When the generals talk, you better listen to him. When the generals talk, you better do what he say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lieutenant General Robert Gard, a graduate from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, who after combat service in Korea and Vietnam became the first Director of Human Resource Development for the U.S. Army and Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. He also served as President of the National Defense University, and after retiring from the U.S. Army in 1981, is currently a Senior Military Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lieutenant General Robert Gard.
I'm happy to participate.
Well, thank you. And it's an extraordinary time in terms of some people are calling the adults in the room in the White House, the generals, McMaster, Kelly, and Mattis, as a kind of benign junta. The idea being that we should take some comfort in then, as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, said, this adult daycare center that the White House has become. But it's also, you know, a little troubling, frankly, and I wanted to get your opinion on this. If you have a bunch of military men at that high level with that much influence, because you have a president who is so demonstrably unqualified to be in that office, does that mean that everything to a military man is he's the hammer and everything's a nail, and that we're going to have a militarized foreign policy?
Well, I think there's a risk of that, but happily in this case, Mattis is quoted of supporting diplomacy in the State Department. I think that he said something to the effect that the less you spend on diplomacy, the more I spend on ammunition. So he seems to be at least a voice of reason in that respect. On the other hand, I do believe it's probably preferable to get people from the civilian sector who are experienced and very knowledgeable in problems at the policy level and not to depend too heavily on people with a military background precisely for the risk that you expressed.
Well, the Military Times has just done a survey of active duty troops, and they found that 53% of military officers oppose Trump, while only 30% hold a positive view of our president. And then amongst the enlisted men, 47% hold a favorable view, and 38% view Trump unfavorably. That's a pretty extraordinary thing. But, you know, the generals were brought into this situation during the campaign. As you recall, Hillary Clinton paraded General John Allen on stage with her at the Democratic National Convention, and Trump paraded retired General Michael Flynn, who also spoke and even chanted, "Lock her up, lock her up." So the situation has been politicized. As somebody that's served in the military and been in Washington a long time, General Gard, let me ask you, do you think that the civilians just should stop parading generals around in order to make score political points and leave generals to the Pentagon and not bring them into politics? Because it looks like General Kelly didn't do so well when he had to go out and defend Donald Trump recently.
No, I quite agree with you that General Kelly got off the reservation, especially in alleging that the member of Congress made some statements that the recording of the particular event belie. And yet he hasn't even apologized for it. And even worse, the public affairs spokesperson for the Trump administration, she said that it was unconscionable for somebody to disagree with him. Well, of course he should be disagreed with when he makes misstatements, and especially when he does so in a political context. Now, on your more basic question, I hold another view. When someone is on active duty, he must be completely non-political and must not take part in any partisan politics. But when an officer retires from the military, he's a citizen, like every other citizen, and has a right to free speech. And I will have to confess to you that I took part as a retired military officer, not using my rank or attempting to influence people because I had been in the military, but simply as a concerned citizen, feeling that I had the right to express my views just like any other citizen.
Well, I certainly wouldn't judge you on that, and I don't think most of our listeners would. But, you know, we're talking about a very different time, and I've mentioned it a few times recently that we are in a situation that's sort of the reverse of that 60s book and movie, 7 Days in May, that posited a military coup by a bunch of right-wing generals because they thought the president was too soft on the Russians. Yeah. And the reverse is true now in many ways, with the generals containing, as Senator Corker refers to it, containing an erratic and dangerous president who has his access to the nuclear button. And frankly, the system is such with the nuclear button that there's no impediment between Trump and his ability to destroy the world.
No, you're absolutely correct. He doesn't have to get anybody's permission. So in that sense, I think Mattis is a sensible person. People who have served in the military, like in every other profession, range all the way from one fringe to the other. I think Mattis is sensible from all I can gather. Flynn, I felt, was dangerous. And I'm very pleased he's no longer in that key role that he was originally appointed to. McMaster, I don't know these people personally, but I know a lot about them, and I know people who know them, and I think they are two sensible people. I was very disappointed in Kelly politicizing, as he did, this issue between Trump and the widow of a deceased service member, and particularly when he says, "Only you who have served in the military may question me." I've lost a good deal of confidence in him after that performance.
But let me just do a quick round robin around the theaters of military activity in the world that the U.S. is involved in, and a lot of them we simply don't know about because there's a lot of deployments all over the world. But let's look at the main ones. We're in the process of watching Iraqi Kurdistan essentially get squeezed. They've lost their economic lifeline. We haven't had Assistant Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of Defense for that part of the world, except for Brett McGurk, who was a holdover. He has no staff. They didn't stop Barzani's people from this ridiculous referendum that's caused this problem because we're not minding the store. We're losing that whole theater to the Iranians who just took Kirkuk. McCain wrote a piece about it in the New York Times today. I think we've lost there because nobody's minding the store. Look at the other theater where we may even have a nuclear war, North Korea. Well, who's the collateral damage there? South Korea. We don't even have an ambassador in South Korea. And in Africa, where you just mentioned the Green Berets who were killed in Niger, we have no Secretary of State for Africa, and we have nobody on the National Security Council in charge of that theater. So this is what alarms me, is how you have a dysfunctional State Department, you have a dysfunctional National Security Council, and I don't know whether it also is true at the Pentagon that the staffing is not up to snuff. But in general, it's true?
It's true. The Pentagon staff is skeletal.
So how the hell are you going to run this superpower on, you know, fumes?
That's a great concern. And, of course, when our president was campaigning, he was talking about pulling back and didn't seem very concerned with needing advice in these areas. The only position he took was to bomb the hell out of ISIS, which apparently he has increased the bombing. But we are sadly lacking in the kind of staff work that is essential, assuming the president would listen to it. But he doesn't seem particularly compatible with listening to people who may have expertise that he lacks. He likes and even advertises that he likes to act on impulse. It's a very dangerous situation.
Well, it's the worst of the both worlds if you have a bellicose and aggressive president who's reckless and not constrained or contained, and then you don't have the intellectual, diplomatic, and military and State Department resources to deal with the very theaters where he's stirring the pot.
That's correct. And you have a Secretary of State who has no diplomatic experience. He's been a very successful executive in the business world. And so he's learning on the job, but he doesn't seem to have the full confidence of the president.
Well, why do people support this president, do you think? I mean, I started out by telling you about the recent poll that just came out from the Military Times, where a majority of active duty military officers in this country, 53%, oppose Trump, while 30% hold a positive view. So we know that the professionals are alarmed about what's going on with their commander-in-chief. But why is there, I mean, yesterday, after a U.S. senator resigned, a Republican, in an impassioned speech calling on his colleagues to show some backbone to oppose this destructive behavior of our president, they went ahead, Mitch McConnell and the Republican caucus, and gave Trump a standing ovation. So how do you explain this disconnect?
Well, it's politics. The American body politic simply is not nearly as concerned about what's happening internationally as it is hoping that President Trump is going to make good on his outlandish promises to make everybody richer. And that seems to be more of a concern. I'm disturbed that the proportion you cited of active duty military officers who support Trump is as high as it is. It's just almost inconceivable to me that people could endorse the activities of the president as he has been conducting himself.
Well, just in closing then, General Guard, is it going to take a catastrophe somewhere for this country to wake up? I mean, this is a president who I often refer to as we have government by stunt. He's so totally incapable of doing the job. So because he's a reality TV guy and a flim-flam salesman type, he engineers all of these television stunts on a daily basis to substitute for policy. And to some extent, he's getting away with it. I don't know that he can get away with it for much longer. But the dangerous part is that these stunts could get out of control, say with North Korea. So that's my question. Is it going to take a catastrophe for this country to wake up and recognize?
Well, the thing that worries me even more is that we'll have a catastrophe. He'll blame it, as he does, on somebody else, and his core of supporters will continue to say, we don't care what he says. We have confidence that he's going to save us all from the neglect that we have suffered over the last two or three administrations.
Right. Right. Well, there's nothing like a little war to boost you in the polls, is there?
That's right. That's probably what would happen. So it's a matter of very serious concern. I share your concern, and I don't know what can be done about it until people in the Congress take enough responsibility to put the country first, not simply to do whatever they feel is necessary to get reelected. Our Congress operates on legalized bribery. I mean, let's call it what it is. If you're a major contributor to a member of the Congress, that member of Congress is highly unlikely to take any positions contrary to the ones that you advocate. And you've got all this money flowing in politics, and you've got these people worried about their jobs. There are only a couple of Republican senators that you just cited who have taken an honest view of the situation, but you don't find the Greek chorus behind them.
Well, Lieutenant General Robert Guard, I thank you very much for joining us here. Appreciate it.
Pleased to participate.
And again, I've been speaking with Lieutenant General Robert Guard, a graduate from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, who after combat service in Korea and Vietnam became the first director of human resources development for the U.S. Army and a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. He also served as president of the National Defense University, and after retiring from the U.S. Army, he's currently a senior military fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was